your Bibles, we're looking again at Ephesians chapter 6, and I'd like to read verses 10 through 17 to you tonight. Daniel, Kristen, thank you for leading us in worship today. You guys are class act. Thank you for that. You're musicians, and so, but you know, which means you're probably saner than preachers, but you know, you're still musicians. Verse 10 says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. So therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, take the shield of faith, which with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one, and take the helmet of salvation." In the ancient days, the great generals were known for their power and strategy, but they were also known as much for their trickery. And so, for instance, Alexander the Great, I think we mentioned that in the Intercom article last month. One of the things Alexander the Great did was that, as great as he was at strategy and as marvelous as he was at killing people, he would also use trickery. And one of the things he liked to do was make helmets and breastplates that would fit a man who would be 7 or 8 feet tall. And when his army was being pursued, he would like to leave those behind the trail. And the ideal was that perhaps the army wouldn't pursue him if they thought it was a huge an army of giants. But even when they would catch up to him, it had an intimidation factor. Hannibal, the great Carthaginian general who sieged Rome and would have defeated Rome if it hadn't been for just a few situations. You wouldn't have heard about the Roman Empire, but one of the great things that Hannibal would do would be to fake surrender. And he would send 10 or 15,000 men to fake surrender. And then they would be on the back lines, and so when he would attack on the front, they would be able to overwhelm those few men who were going to protect them and attack from the rear. And so he was a great trickster. And what the Bible is saying to us is that we have an enemy, and that ought to sink into you. Do you feel that? That there is someone right now planning your demise? There's a power, there's a being right now that has a playbook on how to keep you from going to heaven. That's what I think the Bible's saying. We are in a battle. We are in a battle against a personal devil who, passage says, reigns over an unseen kingdom, enemies in darkness. I take that to be demons. And they are out to stop the work of God, and they are out to stop those who are trying to do the work of God. And they have incredible strength. He has incredible force. If you were to surrender your life to him, and I don't want to go down the road of demonic possession, but I think even that aside, when you see what he is doing in the culture, see what he's doing in the world, you know that he has incredible force, but his method of seduction, his method of destroying a human being, is not so much through that force, but through trickery, through deceit. And so we're told to make a commitment to truth. We're told to make a commitment to doing what's right in any given situation. We're told to put on the shoes of peace. We're told to take up the shield of faith. What are all those things for? They are to, essentially, as we've talked about, to prevent us from being tricked or to be tempted or to be snared by Satan into either quitting the faith or to remaining somewhat in the faith but doing the work of Satan. And I think that probably if he were out to have you doing what he wants you to do most is for you to stay in the church but to serve him while you're in the church. Stay in the body. Don't know that his main goal is to put you on a bar stool, although that seems to be as what often happens for those who are willing to give in to his snare. But he would like to keep you from doing the work of God and from stopping others from doing the work of the Lord. He's a tricky enemy. And so we're told that we need to put on what the Lord has given to us, to put these things on. We've been given them. That's not enough. We have to apply them in our lives. And here tonight, he says you need to put on the helmet of salvation. Now, again, there's issues with, I think, each of these phrases in regard to trying to zero in on exactly what it means. And I think that's true of this phrase as well. Put on the helmet of salvation, Paul says. What is he talking about? And because if you think about salvation, is he talking about getting saved? Is he talking about salvation from sin? Salvation is a past thing. It's a present thing, but it's also future. We will be saved if we persevere to the end. In what tense is he talking about salvation? What is he driving at when he says, what you need for protection is salvation? And it seems to me that 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 helps us to, I think, perhaps zero in on what he's driving at. And it will be on the screen here. But Paul is speaking with this same terminology. In verse 8 he says, but let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love. Now notice he's talking again about the warfare. That's a warfare image. Put on the breastplate of faith and love. And then he says, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. And notice he doesn't just say, put on salvation, but he is more specific. He says, put on the hope of salvation as your helmet. For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Now notice again what Paul's saying. He says you need to take up the hope of salvation, that regardless of what happens in your life, you will live together with him. I think what Paul is driving at here is that to avoid the snare of Satan, we need to have the hope of salvation, that we will be saved not just from the power of Satan, not simply from the pollution of Satan, but ultimately from the very presence of Satan. Not just the power of evil, not just the pollution in the world, but ultimately from the very presence of all that is evil in the world. I think what he's driving at is that you, as a helmet, if you're going to avoid the snare of Satan again, is to take up the hope of salvation, and that needs to be a factor in your life. But ultimately, you'll be with Christ. Now, why is that? Why would Satan try to take your hope? Why would he fight on the issue of hope? And I think the answer is just painfully simple. And this is a very simple sermon. Because hope is something which, if you lose it, you'll quit. You'll quit. If Satan wanted to try to get you to quit, to give up on God, if Satan wanted to get you to walk away from the faith, to leave all that Christ has done for you, how would he get you to do that? Well, he would rob your hope. I mean, we all know that if you lose hope in something, what happens? You'll quit. You'll quit. this Pokemon thing's going around, and I don't even know what that means, really. I think I had to get on Google and try to Google what this thing's about, and it's pretty neat if it's what I think it is, but I'm not sure I know what they're doing with that. I mean, tremendous video game. Now, I grew up on the original Nintendo, so I'm dating myself, and my games are Super Mario Brothers and then Tecmo Bowl. Anybody remember Tecmo Bowl? Then they went to Super Tecmo Bowl. It's football. It was, you know, tremendous technology in the day. It's not 3D, but, you know, you had Mike Tyson's Punch Out, you know. When you're playing Super Tecmo Bowl and you're losing 28-0, you don't finish the game. You're going to get beat. You restart. When you're playing Mike Tyson's Punch Out and you're just about to go down, you don't finish the match. You quit. I mean, if you're playing Super Mario Brothers, you got one life. You're in World 7. You're not making it to World 8-4. You're not saving the princess. You might as well quit. You're not going anywhere. If you know you're going to lose, you stop. We have that in politics, right? It's what the presidential primaries are about. After, Iowa and then after New Hampshire, anybody who doesn't think they have a chance to win, they quit. It's like, why don't you stay in there and run in all 50 states? Because I'm not John Kasich. No, John, but most of the guys, some of them stay in there, but most of the guys say, hey, I don't have a chance of winning. I'm not going to spend any more money. I'm not going to compete. I'm going to go home and try to find something else to do. I'm not going to run a race. I'm not going to win. We've had that to some degree even in our foreign policy, I think. America, you know, even with the crisis in Iraq and Afghanistan, the American population, if we look at a situation, and I'm not talking about everybody, but do you look at a situation and generally in the American population, if there isn't a path to winning, we tend to say, let's bring the troops home. I mean, we might be winning every battle, but they keep coming. We're going to be there for 30 years. This is not a winnable situation. And oftentimes the American public will say, oh, we've got to come home. Now, whether or not that's right or not is a different thing. But there is something called war fatigue. And war fatigue is if it doesn't look like we're winning in the time that we should be winning, let's just find a way to get out. If you think you're not going to win, you quit. Sometimes you'll talk to a wife or a husband and they're there alone and they want to talk about their marriage and ultimately they're talking to you and the question is there any hope that it's going to get better? And that's what they want to find out. Because if they reach that point where they say there's no hope that it's going to get any better, this is it, and it's probably going to get worse, then that's the breaking point. Why would I stay in this? I'm wasting the last half of my life. I'm going to get out. And so the point is that if you think you're going to lose, you quit. But conversely, if you have an assurance that you're going to win, you tend to stay in it. You tend to stay in it. And so what it's saying here, at least in 1 Thessalonians, is, if as a Christian, you have a hope that you will be with Christ, that ultimately whatever happens on this world and in this time period, ultimately you're going to be with Christ in heaven, then you'll stay in. And so that's a place that Christ wants to, that the Satan wants to attack you at. The hope. He wants to take that hope away from you. See, I think I've mentioned this before. I think it was Karl Marx who called religion the opiate of the people. And what he was saying is that religious people tend to cling to religion. But one of the reasons why communism and religion, particularly Christianity, could never coexist and why communism would want to drive Christianity out of an outlaw Christianity and practically every other religion for that matter, was according to Karl Marx, and I think I've shared this before, if you have people who are heavenly minded, they won't work for earthly good. at least in his theory, people say, I'm going to heaven, then they're not going to work to make the world a better place. They're not going to be good comrades. And so he wanted to distance his people from religion. But actually, that's not the way life works. From the Christian perspective, you can sacrifice, you can give up, you can lose. If Satan takes it from you, you can gladly give it up if you know you're going to win in the end. If you have a hope of ultimate salvation. And that's what drives people like Mother Teresa, you know. Whatever you think of her, that's just an example that everybody knows. But how do you give 50, 60, 70 years of your life working in the slums of India? How do you give up everything? Because you know that you're really not giving up everything. You have heaven to gain. See, and so you can give it up or you can have it taken. If Satan wants to do to you what Job, what happened to Job, if you have the hope of ultimate salvation, you can give it up. You can lay it down because ultimately you know you're not going to lose in the end. You're not going to lose in the end. People do all kinds of, I mean, think about Acts chapter 2, where Holy Spirit comes and they get a vision of the church and they get a vision of Christ. And what does it say? They sold all that they had all things in common. How can you do that? How can you sell all that you have? Or if Satan wants to take everything from you, how can you live like that? Because you have a hope of future glory. Think about these two people here. Think about John Wesley. John Wesley preached his last sermon in 1791. And he preached on a text, "Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near." And then he got very sick and he was in his deathbed and he had several days of illnesses in which he would lay and sing one of his brother's hymns, which said, I the chief of sinners am, but Jesus died for me. And then on his deathbed, he's very sick and he knows that his time is short. And his last words were, "The best of all is God is with us." The best of all is God is with us. Think about a guy like D.L. Moody. I just have one more after this. But he had to come off the field where he was preaching revivals. He became again very, very sick. And he told his family, he said, "I'm not discouraged. I want to live as long as I am useful, but when my work is done, I want to be up and off." And he became very sick and his body turned on him. And that last night he said, "Earth recedes, heaven opens before me." And his son thought that his father was dreaming. And he said, "No, this is not a dream, Will. It is beautiful. It's like a trance. If this is death, it is sweet. There is no valley here. God is calling me and I must go." And he died. And you take those two guys. They had less than this last guy. They didn't have his money. They were wore out. They were sick. They were physically drained. But this last guy, he was wealthy and his health held as well as anybody's. His name was Mark Twain. But listen to what Mark Twain said shortly before he died. He said, "A myriad of men are born. They labor and sweat and struggle. They squabble and scold and fight. They scramble for little mean advantages over each other. Age creeps upon them. Sickness follows. Those they love are taken from them. And the joy of life is turned to aching grief. Death comes at last, the only unpoisoned gift earth ever had for them. And they vanish from the world where they were of no consequence, a world which will mourn them a day and forget them forever." It's very positive, isn't it? Very positive. Now, what's the difference? One had the hope of salvation. The hope of salvation. Mark Twain got to the end of his life and absolute negativity, although he had a wonderful life. But the other two guys knew that while they may be sick, while they may have missed out on a lot, while maybe Satan had prevented them from having certain things, they had the hope of salvation and helmet on. Look at Isaiah chapter 11, if you will. Just briefly, and I'll be finished with you tonight. It's going to be up here. I spoke too soon. Have you got it, Chad? Yeah, okay. A great passage. Listen to this. And more, what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the enemy. Women received their dead raised to life again. But then it turns, all these great men who did great things of the faith, all these great women, but it says, but others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourging, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Think about that. And these are people who came under the fiery persecution of Satan, sawed in half, ran like a fugitive. But how were they able to do that? Because they believed in a better resurrection. In fact, the others there, and I just want to read this and I'll be just about finished. But the others there, a lot of commentators think refer to what happened under when Antioch Epiphanes invaded Israel 160 or so years before. And it's in the book of 2 Maccabees. If you have a Bible with the Apocrypha, 2 Maccabees is in there. And it tells some of these stories. But one of the famous stories was a mother with seven sons. And they brought the sons out and they asked each son, will you disobey the law of God? Will you renounce God? Is what they were asking. And if they didn't, and this is going to get graphic, the king commanded that his tongue be cut off, that they be scalped, that their legs and then arms be cut off, and then barely breathing, they were roasted alive over a fire one after another. Now think about this. The most vicious kind of torture that would be devised by humanity. And each son refused to renounce God. Tongue cut out, scalped, limbs cut off, roasted over the fire. And as each son was being sawn, having their legs and arms sawed off, the mother stood there. And she would say to the sons, it was not I who gave you life and breath. It was the creator of the world who devised the origin of all things and who will in his mercy give life and breath back to you again since you now forget yourself for his sake. What's she saying? She's saying, sons, endure it. Endure it. There's a better resurrection. Don't lose the hope of salvation here. And so each one of the sons died bravely. In fact, one of the sons, when called before the king, put out his tongue, stretched forth his hands, and said, take them. I got them from heaven, and for God's sake, I give them up, and from him, I will get them back. And then it says, and again, this won't help your appetite tonight, but Maccabee said, and with blood now gushing forth, He took out his own entrails with both hands and hurled them, and with his dying breath called upon the Lord of life to give them back to him again. These guys were being persecuted by all the demon powers. But they withstood it. They did not renounce Christ because they had on the helmet of salvation. They had on a hope that ultimately they would be saved, that this was not the end, that there was a better resurrection ahead. Wherever you're at, again, the helmet's got to be put on. We know that the Christian life is full of trials. We know that the Christian life is full of losses. But you know people, and I know people, who just quit. Just quit. Satan is able, and through the ways that life works, and maybe he's behind it, maybe it's just the way life is, he's able to shake people, and they give up on the faith. They walk away because they have lost the hope of ultimate salvation, that there is a better resurrection ahead. And that's something that you've just got to hold on to wherever you're at, wherever you're at. And I'm not where you guys are. I'm still, I don't always feel that way. I guess I'm in the prime of life. I don't know. Am I in the prime? I feel like it passed me by 15 years ago, but I feel like prime of life. I haven't experienced the losses that you have. My wife is with me. My children are with me. My parents are still with me. I haven't experienced the losses that you have. But I pray that as you have, put on the helmet, the hope of salvation, where your faith isn't shaken during those times, that I'll be able to do that. And if you're being shaken tonight, listen to me. It's a better resurrection. It's a better resurrection. If you're losing everything, there's a better place. And to withstand Satan, it's important that you remember it, that you put it on. Will you stand with me? I want to pray with you. Father, you know that there are people